I will officially start now, if you're cool with that. These are my, this is my slating hand. cool. All right. So today, I am very excited to bring to the show a person who is just, how do I say it, extremely good at things. He is a software engineer. He is a writer. He is a Smashburger chef. He's a good person. He's an artist. He is a true talent. Please welcome to the Last Tech Podcast, Jason Langsdorf. Jason, thanks for being here.
I am really going to struggle to live up to that intro. Thank you so much.
That was the short list. I deleted things from it just from a list perspective. But you are a multi-hyphenate, a talent with no equal. So thank you so much for being here. It's awesome.
So happy to be here. It's any chance to hang out with you, Eve, is a pleasure.
Well, we did get to hang out a few times in Portland. I feel like I know you very well because of the internet, but maybe I don't. Maybe I have a parasocial relationship with you, but I'm glad that you're here. A rumor that I've heard about you throughout time, a rumor, is that you're from Montana. Tell me about that.
I am from Montana. I lived in Montana until, let's see, when did I move? About 2010, 2011, I moved to Portland. Cool. And I grew up in Whitefish, which is a small town about an hour from the Canadian border. It's by Glacier National Park, which might be a landmark people recognize. When I was growing up there, it was becoming a resort town. Today, it is fully a resort town. And then after Whitefish, which is where I graduated high school, I went to Missoula, Montana, and I stayed there for several years. That's where I launched my agency. That's where I kind of got into the tech scene, which was a whole interesting thing in and of itself. And that was also what I did as my test to see if I could handle something city-like before I moved to the big city.
Totally. I didn't realize you were from Whitefish either. That's very cool. Did you have to walk around with bear spray in your daily life?
I was more of an indoor pet, but I mean, actually thinking back on it, when I was growing up, this was the 90s, right? So we had like the parent style of get out of the house and don't come home till it's dark, because we kind of lived out at the edge of the woods, and I guess we maybe should have had bear spray, but we didn't. But you know, it was the full feral childhood. Like all the neighborhood kids would just run around and torture each other, and you know, hit each other with sticks and find dead things to poke. And you know, it was just a whole like very like about as Montana as you can imagine. You know, I remember there were definitely times when we would like before our parents confiscated them, we had BB guns, and we would like hunt our younger siblings with BB guns.
As you should. Montana rite of passage, absolutely. Yeah, that is weird how our parents would just let us loose on the town and be like, when it's dark, come home. And no, not a lot of parenting went on in my household, but I don't know.
it was really wild. I remember like my whole high school career, I'd get up and go to school. And then after school, me and a close friend of mine would just kind of walk in this triangle between my house, his house, and the place where all the kids hung out, which in Whitefish is called City Beach. Okay. And it was maybe a 20-minute walk, so I must have been doing 40,000 steps a day at that stage in my life, which, man, I wish that was still true.
Pre-Apple Watch, yeah.
But we'd just kind of do a slow lap, and we were constantly walking and trying to find something interesting to do, but there was very little, like, structure. You know, me or my friends weren't in sports, we weren't in after school clubs or anything, so we were just kind of like entertaining ourselves with skateboards and trying, you know, seeing if we could, oh, that girl I have a crush on might be at the beach, let's walk over there and see if she's there so we can stand awkwardly and look at her.
it works every time. If you stare enough, it will pay dividends.
I did. In fact, I had my first kiss as a teenager at the top of the hill leading down to City Beach because of my strategy of Amazing. Doing laps around City Beach and trying to project that I was available without actually making eye contact or speaking.
Like I said, it works. So, yeah. That's amazing. Well, that is a good skill to pick up on at that time. You also had mentioned you started your agency in Missoula. How did that all come about, like striking out on your own so early?
So I was in my early 20s, And I had spent the end of my teens and the very beginning of my 20s trying to make it as a musician. Yeah. And we'd been touring for several years. The last couple of years, we were playing like hundreds of shows a year. I think we did 200 shows in 2006. And when I got back to Missoula, I realized that like I wasn't going to be a musician. We were in a trend that wasn't really going to continue, and like our fans were half our age at that point. And I was like, I don't want to do this. This isn't fun. So I was like, okay, well, now what am I going to do though? And I realized that through the band, I had built enough skills as a like project manager, as a designer, because I had to do our merch and our flyers and stuff, as a like a coordinator, because I had to book shows, I had to make sure the band showed up on time, I had to figure out how to get a group of teenagers in Phoenix, Arizona to go print and hang up flyers for us so anybody would show up to the show when we got there. And I'd built our website, I'd customized our MySpace page, I'd done all sorts of these odd jobs that sort of keep a band operating. And I realized that if I took the band out and I looked at the collection of odd jobs, I was like, wait, I'm a design agency. Yeah. And so I started doing freelance web work, and you know, got my first couple projects. Like a parent of a friend hired me to do a little thing, and I built another friend's parents' karate school website, and it was all just kind of like little stuff around town through friends of friends. But then I got my first job offer, and I found a web company that was willing to pay me $30,000 a year, and I was going to be a web designer. Right about the same time, another friend was starting a big project. They wanted to be like the website builder for opera singers. I get that was their network, was like all of these kind of classical performers. And they offered me $3,000 a month for a guaranteed 3 months. And I did the math and I was like, wait, that's more money if it works out. And so I went to the agency or the company that was going to hire me, and I said, like, what's the growth potential here? And they're like, well, if you do really well, we'll get you up to 34 eventually. And I was like, that's a low cap. And so I just kind of was like, well, I don't have a lot to lose, so let's try this freelance thing. And at that point, I could like formed the agency. I formed a business, and you know, I registered an LLC. Let's be real here.
Still counts.
But I did that for a couple years, and then it sort of expanded, and I became an agency I started bringing in subcontractors, and eventually had a few employees, and that was what I did up until 2014. So seven-ish years of agency work.
Nice. So what kinds of projects would the agency take on mostly?
At first, it was whatever I could get my hands on. And then through just sort of the referral network, I became the de facto website builder for people in the fitness industry. So from probably 2009 to 2014, I built a huge number of websites for people who are in like the small personal trainers. So local personal trainers, local training companies, and then also online, like buy my fitness PDF folks who are like the bloggers and fitness journalists, people writing for, you know, Men's Fitness and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And somehow that became like the thing I did, which was very funny because I have never been a fitness person. And so I would meet them, and it was very like, I used to go to fitness conferences to network.
Yeah.
And so I would show up there, and I was like the only person who wasn't in like fitness wear with a six pack, and like, you know, they're all like drinking protein shakes, and I'm like carrying around a cheeseburger. Like,
none of these people can build your website, y'all. Totally. Yeah.
I guess it was advertising, because they were like, you are definitely not in fitness. Why are you here? And then I got to explain, in fact, I'll build your website.
Explain
they're like,
yourself.
Oh, that tracks.
I love that. But I also think it's very like, I think it's a funny thing to, when we set out to start a business or set out to do whatever we do, it's like you can get really gripped onto, I have to do this one thing and it has to be this. And I think your flexibility led you into this really cool like realm that you wouldn't think you would work in.
I have this theory that most of us have a trajectory that we think we should follow.
Yeah.
And then there's like this sort of quieter, almost like magnetic north that you can like feel it if you're listening for it, but you don't necessarily have it mapped out. And it, that to me is usually opportunity, because as you're working on something, you'll feel this little tug that's like, this actually feels like the thing I should be doing. And if you squash that down to follow the path, it can put you somewhere that you wanted to be, but it might not be the right place that you wanted to go. And I mean, my whole career is like that. Like today, like I started out 2009 building fitness websites, and today I make YouTube videos.
Yeah.
And I swear to God, that story connects. Like, I never did a career pivot. I've just literally chased that little thing that was like, this is the next opportunity. And I've just sort of taken little detours and turns that have all turned into, like, my next jump was still within my career. You know, I never, like, quit tech to be a video person. I just sort of evolved as I saw different lights come on. I was like, that could work and that could work. And then if we connected these things, then, you know, now I do whatever it is I do now.
Totally. It's all very additive, right? You're just mm-hmm. like, everything is piling on top of each other to make a thing that no one else can do. And I think that's very evident in your work in particular. So that's awesome. So 2014 comes along. What happened then?
I was very bad at running a business. So there are a lot of lessons that I'm definitely a learn the hard way kind of person, which I hate about myself. But I was running the agency and I was going for scale. Like, I wanted more clients and more turnover. I hadn't learned how to, like, move up market though. So everything I was selling was really low margin, mm-hmm. and I was hiring contractors, so the margins were even lower. And so I got to the point where, like, my entire life was sales and putting out fires. Yeah. And I didn't get to build. I didn't get to play anymore. I wasn't designing anything. And really all I did was, like, if a contractor got sick, I got to go in and bail out that project. Mm-hmm. And that was the closest I ever really got to, like, doing the thing that I liked. And I was working, like, 90-hour weeks and really stressed out, like, always, you know, so sliding into credit card debt because, you know, you'd start to catch up and then you'd have a bad week and then crap, I gotta borrow from the emergency fund, and you're just, like, deeper and deeper. And so in 2014, or I guess in 2012, my beard started to just, like, get patchy, and it was going white, and then it started falling out in chunks along my chin, and I was like, that seems bad. Like, that shouldn't be happening, right? And then I Googled it,
probably
and
nothing.
There was
it's
a,
probably fine. Yeah.
It was one of those, like, it's called alopecia barbadensis or something, and the official line on it is, we don't know why this happens because they can't prove it. But the unofficial line is, it's typically stress-induced alopecia. Yeah. And so so this is stress. This is, you know, I'm clearly not living a life that I'm enjoying. Like, I wake up on my phone responding to emails. I ignore my friends through meals to, like, send off one little quick follow-up. I go to bed until my phone falls on my face, right? Yeah. And I'm not actually enjoying it. I'm, like, ignoring the relationships in my life. I don't have hobbies. And I sort of had this like, go to Alaska moment, right? And I mean that quite literally. I tried to turn it around from 2012 to 2014, but then I just hit a point where I was like, I gotta be done. So I sold my interest in the agency to a couple of the people who were at the agency, my other two employees. They took over, and I took a flight to Alaska and went to a place called Thorne Bay that, like, there aren't even roads there. Like, you have to go in by seaplane. The internet is so slow that it took us 40 minutes to download a fishing license. There's just nothing to do there, right? There's no cell reception or anything. And so I just spent a little while there being completely unplugged and trying to prove to myself that the world didn't end if I wasn't, like, on. And so, you know, I didn't come back in a great situation because, you know, again, I was, like, in credit card debt and all that kind of stuff. But I came back and just realized, like, this is what I need to be doing. Like, I need to be taking care of myself. And so I reintroduced myself to work as work is a thing in service of building a life that's worth leading and not the other way around. So I took one contract. It paid me less, but it paid me enough. And it all in probably took me, I don't know, 20 hours a week to do the work. And I just didn't look for more contracts. I was like, I'm going to be fine, right? This is okay. And I, my then girlfriend, now wife, she and I just spent a couple years like bouncing around between different countries. We lived in Thailand and Vietnam and Europe, and we were kind of everywhere that we wanted to go and see. And I just did these contracts along the while, and she was transitioning from her previous career into, she's now a UX designer and researcher. That 2 years of sort of just being disconnected and not having a lot of work started out being really restorative. Like, obviously, you know, my beard's back, so I healed. And then it turned into this huge existential crisis of like, okay, I could just do this forever. Like, I could be, you know, this could be Peter Pan and the Lost Boys. Like, we just never go back. We take these little contracts, but we never do anything. Like, we're not impacting anything. We're just kind of collecting a small check, and like, we're not even part of these cultures because we don't stay long enough to actually meet people and make friends. So that's when I got back into the world of like building and community. But my goal wasn't like build the biggest business or build the biggest agency. In fact, I swore I would never be independent again. Spoiler alert, that didn't happen. But but I came back saying like, I'm going to get a corporate job. I'm just going to 9-to-5 it. And my whole goal is to like build a community that I can really be connected to. Yeah. And that was IBM. And then that's kind of led to the rest of the jumps that got me to today.
Totally. Well, during that whole thing, were you creating content at that time? I feel like I've read the story about your beard before, and or was that a later thing?
It was at the same time. My early content creation stuff was really piecemeal because it was never a goal. It was just a thing I liked to do. Yeah. And so I had like made some stuff with Chris Coyer. He'd worked with me on like some CodePen things, or not CodePen, CSS Tricks things. And then I spoke at a couple conferences and somehow miraculously got a book deal off of like an article I wrote on CSS Tricks. That turned into 3 books. And so I'd like made a lot of content. This is another part of the reason why I was so burned out going into 2014 is like I did all of that while I was trying to get this agency off the ground. So between 2014 and 2016, I did a couple things. Like I made a couple videos on YouTube where I was explaining how to do like Node stuff. I had needed to figure out how to stand up a server with a firewall. And so I was like working with WordPress. I was working with, I can't even remember what it was. Oh, I needed to like provision an SSL cert. And this was right at the beginning of Let's Encrypt and Certbot and stuff, I think 2015. Yeah. So there weren't a lot of guides. So as I was doing this, I was assembling my notes so I could do it again in the future. And I was like, I'm just going to record this. And so I made it a YouTube video. And that kind of like, to this day, is still one of my top performing videos, right? And I was like, that was actually really fun. I like making video. But I was really inconsistent, so I don't think I made videos more than once a year for, you know, until 2018. It was kind of like I was making content, but it definitely was like when I feel like it, when I get inspired.
Yeah. And that led into the speaking stuff that you did. When was your first foray into speaking?
That was in Montana way back. So in probably 2007-ish. I was going to this group called Montana Programmers, and it was so small. There were like 14 people. You couldn't focus on a language. So like everybody was there because they were a programmer, not because they used like JavaScript or PHP or Java. It was just like, I work on computers. Do you work on computers? Do you want to hang out? Yeah. And so I gave a talk on, I don't know, something with PHP that I was doing for, at the time I had the hubris that I think all young programmers have, where we believe we should build our own CMS because clearly everybody else did it wrong.
Obviously.
So I was teaching something that I had learned and somebody was like, that was really cool. You should do more of that. And I was like, that actually was really fun. And it fulfilled this gap that was left in my life after not being performing anymore. Because I did miss, like, I don't really miss being a musician, but I do really like the performance and the collaboration with an audience kind of standpoint of things. But my speaking was really spotty. I used it almost primarily as a networking thing. So I'd, like, apply to a conference because I could not afford to pay for the ticket. And so I was speaking so that I could go meet people in the industry, which is how I ended up with my job at IBM. Is I would go to this conference to speak, and I would hang out with my friend Robin Cannon, who at the time was the design man or the engineering manager for the carbon design team at IBM. And he ended up hiring me at IBM when I did decide that I wanted to go into corporate. So earnestly speaking, I would say started in 2017.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to go back to this, because I'll cut this out, but what kind of genre was your music?
We were like emo screamo stuff. Yeah. So we were playing at the same time that bands like Fall Out Boy and Hawthorne Heights and Newfound Glory were at their peak.
Yeah.
And we sounded a lot like, if you ever heard Thrice?
Yeah.
We just ripped Thrice off as hard as we could. Like, we wanted to be Thrice so bad.
That's amazing. You said that you had these, like, fans that were half your age, and it was making me think of my husband Alex's friend was in a band very similar genre to that, and he was on the older side of things, maybe older than you were at that time, but maybe 30. And he was like, yeah, I tell everyone I'm 21 because all these people in the audience insist that I be that age. So
was really interesting because when we started, we were 17 and the audience was 17. And then when I was 21, the audience was like 13.
Yeah.
Because the trend was sort of going down to younger kids, and the older kids didn't think it was cool anymore. So we basically like aged out of our audience. And then it used to be fun because like after the show, we'd go hang out with people who are our age.
Yeah.
And then toward the end, it was weird because like our whole strategy had always been we'd play a show and then ask for a place to stay. And that worked out great when everybody was our age. It was really weird. The moment when I realized that the band was done was I met after the show, two girls came up and they said, you can stay with us. And I said, okay, where do you live? And they're like, well, hold on. Before we do that, I got to ask my mom. And then they went back and they asked their mom, who was like not that much older than me. And I talked to her and I was like, how old are your kids? And she said, well, they're 10 and 12. And I was like, okay, we got to not do this anymore. Like, we're not staying at a 10-year-old's house. This is too weird.
Probably not. Probably time to start that agency. File that
LLC.
Yeah,
right. It was like, it was, you know, and it got very weird when I started being friendlier with the parents of our fans than with our fans themselves.
Totally. A moving target, finding your audience. That's so amazing. Yeah. But yeah, I think that performance thing is so obvious in everything we're talking about, like the additive nature of things. Like, you obviously are using all those skills now when you are doing your videos and shows.
There was a really fun, this book that I read called How We Got to Now. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of this idea of like how inventions, created possibilities that led to other inventions and how that affected society and all that kind of stuff. But there's this concept inside of it, at least I think it was this book, called The Adjacent Possible. And it's sort of this thinking that like, you don't just invent a jet engine, right? You invent a jet engine after somebody has come up with jet fuel and, you know, aerial flight and, you know, the wheel and how to refine steel and, you know, all these things that had to happen first. So like, In caveman days, the wheel and fire were like the only two inventions that were really possible until they got those. And then once they had those, it was like, oh, wait, now we can make a cart or we can make a torch or we can, you know, build like heated indoor spaces or whatever it was. Right. And I think that our careers are kind of like that as well, where as we do stuff, like anything that you do is letting you build and refine a skill. And then that skill is now available to you, right? You can now use that however you want. And the really interesting thing is if you start looking around for what this new skill unlocks, and again, that's sort of like instead of looking at the established trajectory, like I've learned how to do math, now I will become an accountant. You can say, all right, well, I've learned math. What else does this unlock? And then there's, you know, all these cool things that you can do or like programming or design or any of these things. Once you've got that skill, you can plug that into other things and then you get interesting new things. It's like crafting in Minecraft or something. Like you can just start combining stuff in weird ways and see what happens, and find that in fact there is a role out there for somebody who is a like designer, developer, and like marketing person who also really likes falling down the rabbit hole of video production. So it's very much you sort of get to build your own adventure, but only if you're thinking about your skills as additive, instead of saying that like, oh, I've wasted so much time if I was a designer first and then I switched to dev and now I'll never do design again because I'm a developer now, right? Like, no, think about how those fit together and how much stronger that makes you if you think about how those pieces augment each other and kind of unlock new possibilities.
Yeah, for sure. When you were doing your screamo emo band times, I was doing sketch comedy and theater stuff, and we had a teacher who was always like, you guys need to go do something different than this improv stuff that you're doing all the time, because all your scenes are about improv. And it was very much like, you need to have other experiences outside of that. So I see that related so much with developers. Like, you're just on Twitter all day and Reddit all day and Hacker News all day. And maybe getting outside of that will bring some fresher ideas into the mix. So I think you
absolutely
do that with cooking and smash burgering and all the music things you do too. So that's really cool. That's not a question. That's just an observation. new at this. So when you got into kind of like the most recent arc of your career, you're working at all these dev tool startups and things, and you started doing Learn with Jason alongside that too. Tell me how that idea came about and how that has graced our screens.
Yeah. So in 2018, I was working at Gatsby, and they hired me at Gatsby without a plan. It was just sort of like, do you want to work here? So when I joined, there was a very big aspect of sort of choose your own adventure with what you're going to be in charge of. And the thing that I leaned toward was the community building side, because we had good engineers. I didn't need to build stuff. We needed somebody to pay attention to the stuff we were building. And nobody seemed to want to do that. So I was like, great, I got it. And I started building out different programs. And then what I realized was like a lot of what was missing was just the sense of like, who else is doing this? Like, how do I get connected to other people who are building this way? And my first idea was, I will bring people from the community on and answer their questions in a live stream. I was experimenting with live streaming in general. Like, I had some early experiments that were bad. Like, I would stream Gatsby internal meetings. Nobody cared. Like, it was not interesting. But then I tried this, where I'd bring on somebody from the community who would ask me a question. I'd say, hey, do you want to come learn this on a live stream? And I did that a couple times, but the power dynamics felt wrong. Like, I was asking somebody who was already having to like say, hey, I don't know this, could you teach this to me? And then I was saying, great, will you come not know it in front of a bunch of strangers? So I flipped that and I said, I'm going to start bringing on people who are good at things and have them teach me. So I'll pretend not to know, so that they get to show off something that they've learned that they're really good at. And we get that same experience of like, so everybody gets to learn something together, but I'm not putting an individual on the spot to be the one who doesn't know. Like, I'll be the one who doesn't know. And as soon as I did that, it hit. So for a long time, it was like a Gatsby, I think I even called it something like that. Like, I had a silly name for it because Gatsby was all inside jokes, but it was the original version of Learn with Jason was, I think, 4 or 5 episodes of me just bringing in different community members who'd built something cool. They'd show me how to do it with Gatsby. And then I started to expand and think like, well, actually, I think this would be cooler if it was just about the web. And like, if it makes sense to use Gatsby, I will, which is what got the attention of Sarah Drasner. And then, well, I think that's what got the attention of Sarah. I'm not sure what I did, but at some point Sarah Drasner emailed me and was like, you should come work at Netlify. And I was like, no. I still can't believe I did that, but I was like, no, I'm not going to do it. And sure. So she, it was really funny because years later we're friends, and I was talking to her not that long ago, and her husband Dizzy he told me, it was really funny when you told Sarah no, because she came back and she told me exactly what was going to happen and how long it would take before you joined her team. And she was exactly right. And I was
like, that seems right. Yeah.
And my illusion of free will just evaporated. Yeah.
the long game. The Drasner long game is very fresh, yeah.
So Netlify was like a perfect fit for me because my general approach is like I'm curious about things and I want to build everything. And Netlify's whole goal was like we want to be the home for the web. So Sarah was like, come here and do what you're doing, but do it at Netlify, and that'll be good. So I retained control of the show, which was, you know, a stunning moment of foresight on my part, where I got Gatsby to like give me rights to it, and then I was able to take it to Netlify, and then later it became my own thing. But yeah, just sort of emerged out of like my desire to play with stuff, and like the busier I get, the less likely it is that I have time to really sit down with a new piece of tech and try it. So Learn with Jason is my way of getting somebody who already knows the tech to show it to me. And so I can dedicate 90 minutes to like checking out what this thing is and how it works. And with expert guidance, you can actually get really far. And what I've heard from people who watch the show is that that's why they like it, is that, you know, they're too busy in their jobs to like go try this stuff themselves. So seeing somebody who's at, you know, at or near their level as an engineer, who can then go through it and answer the question, you know, get the questions answered that they would have had anyways, or if they're really interested, they watch live and ask the questions right there, then they get to sort of keep up with what's going on without having to like sit down with each piece of tech and try it out.
So Learn with Jason is something that is good and also looks good. So why does it matter to have things look good and be good? Can't we just churn out some bullshit that no one really likes and isn't interesting at all? Why have you chosen that route of good over not?
Why have I chosen good over not good?
A lot of people make the decision for not good, and they're like, we'll just bang something out. Who cares?
I think there is, like, I've actually gotten a lot of feedback that I've made my life harder than I need to. And I don't think that people are wrong when they say that. I have taken the hard way here, and part of it is I'm at the bottom of everything, just a little bit broken and a little bit bougie. And I just want to do things the way that I can imagine they could be done, as opposed to, you know, what's possible right now. But the other part of it, I think, is I really like the lo-fi approach that we see on like TikTok and stuff like that. Like True goes by Mew True on TikTok and Twitter and everything is absolutely brilliant at this. And yeah, I've never seen someone who's so capable of sitting down and recording something in like 10 seconds longer than the edited video is. Like, she's so good and she's so fast, and she does it all with her phone, and it like amazing. The problem that I have with that is that I like story, and I don't have a natural instinct for story. So when I go to, you know, I'm very context heavy, as anyone who's been listening for the last 30 minutes may have noticed. I like to fill in details, and I like to go on side quests, and I like to dive down a rabbit hole of like, oh, this thing that's sort of related. So I don't do short form well. And so when I do it, it looks like I have picked up my phone and started like monologuing at the camera. So I'm sort of playing to my strengths by doing all the editing and stuff that I do, because it allows me to sort of get it out of my system. I might talk for an hour and a half and then release 3 minutes, but those 3 minutes are really good because I got all the rest of it out of my system. And I think the other piece of it too is that I really enjoy the cinema side of things. Like, I like learning about cameras. I like learning about lighting. I like building sets. You know, like this behind me, I built all this. I designed it, and I've put together all the cameras that I use, and you know, my lighting setup is just a painstaking, very expensive process of me buying something and trying it and getting feedback, and somebody tells me, oh, well, it'd look really good if you had this, and I'm like, okay, I guess I'll go buy that. And so, you know, but to me, that's fun. Like, I like these sort of side quests. And so selfishly, it's just a thing I enjoy. Yeah. From a professional standpoint, I think that there's a time and a place for every type of content. And depending on what you're trying to communicate, one or the other is going to be better served. Like, I think the lo-fi thing is really, really good for like quick stories or trying to inform the cultural meta. It's not so good when you're trying to do like longer form tutorials, when you're trying to explain deeper concepts because, like, well, there are definitely exceptions to that rule. But I think that, like, the people who are really good at making it look lo-fi are actually doing a lot of production work to make it look lo-fi. And folks that are not in the tech sphere that do this are like, if you look at a Casey Neistat video, it looks lo-fi, but it's the opposite of lo-fi. Like, he's putting so much thought into this, the crafting of a story and the production. And yes, he's handwriting things and, like, moving pieces of paper around to do his infographics. But there's a lot of design that went into that and a lot of thought that went into that. So when somebody is like, well, I'll just do the Casey Neistat thing, and they top down film their notebook while they write, it doesn't hit the same. And it gets really hard to watch if somebody goes longer than just a few seconds. So my view is that when you've got something that needs to be said the same way across the company, when you're trying to communicate, not just like I feel, but we feel, or we believe, then there's a little more craft that needs to go into what are the words that get used? How do people feel when they see this image? Like, what's the tone that we're conveying when you look at what we're putting on screen? And, you know, does it feel expensive? Like, when you watch this, do you get the same feeling as when you put on a high quality pair of shoes, or when you walk into a fancy restaurant and you kind of go, oh yeah, this is a nice place, right? And a lot of what I'm doing is trying to work on that sort of, like, the subtle emotional parts of, like, what makes a thing feel good. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. Could I do it for a lot less money and a lot less gear? I hope so. I mean, I assume I could, but I'm not going to find out. I'm going to keep doing it this way.
Totally. I love that. And I think, yeah, it just really, I said that to compliment you, to, it really comes through how you care deeply about how people are feeling. Like, it does create a whole vibe of just, I don't know. It stands out in a way that a lot of things don't. So that's all I was saying. I wasn't trying to knock anybody.
Well, I think, I mean, it is something that I have a lot of fear about the way that I talk about this stuff, because the worst thing that I have done and the worst thing that I've seen other people do is they think they can't start until they're at a certain level.
Yeah.
And so the thing to keep in mind, and that I have to keep in mind, is that I will never wait until I have X piece of gear to do a thing, right? Like, when I started Learn with Jason, it was me on my MacBook using the MacBook camera, and I didn't have a microphone, and it was a Zoom call that I just screen recorded, right? Those were the first couple of episodes of Learn with Jason. And as I learned more, I did more stuff. And so if you compare the first episode to an episode that I did in 2020 to an episode that I did last week, there are huge quality jumps. And that's because incrementally I learned more about what I was doing, and I got gear because I had learned why that gear was important to me. And I've also, like, you know, stripped certain things out. Like, I used to have really busy overlays because I was like, it'll look professional if I've got designed overlays. Now my overlays are like the person's name and just big video, because I want to feature the people on the show. I don't want to distract with anything else. But that's all stuff that I, you know, you kind of learn where you should be putting in a lot of effort and where you shouldn't. Yeah. But it shouldn't, none of that should prevent you from starting. Like, all you have is a phone, use your phone. Like, get something out there, because you can't build quality without building reps. Like, you have to try it so that you can look at what you did and say, I would do it like this next time to make it better. But you don't get that review if you don't ship something.
Your stuff is good because you have great equipment and know-how about video production, but it's because you're you, and you're sharing, like, your educational chops with people. So it could be filmed on something like just some iPhone 3 and it would still be great. But the whole vibe of everything is obviously that additive mm-hmm. thing where you're learning more and more, you're getting more seasoned with video production. So it's all good.
Yeah. I mean, I'm 1,000 reps in at this point, and I don't think I'm being hyperbolic when I say that.
Totally.
So each one of those was a chance for me to look at it and go, ooh, I didn't like that I did that. I'm not going to do that next time.
Yeah, for sure. So when you're working with new clients on these projects that are a little more, you've said, developer TV-like, where it's, we're going to see the Netflix show of yours and the
I hope
Hulu
so.
Original, whatever it is. But I think that's just going to happen. But when you're communicating with clients about this, how do you go through the process of ideation where you're trying to get across their marketing objectives, but also make it so fun?
So I try to start with research. Start by talking about what are their goals and what are their challenges. And they'll start saying, you know, well, it's, we want adoption or whatever. And so there's kind of some stuff that every company will say. And if you keep asking why, they'll get to the more interesting thing of like what their real challenge is. And then from there, I try to get access to what the customers say. So if they've got customer research or they've got recorded calls or something like that, I want to hear not like how does the CEO describe the company, but how does somebody who paid for it describe the company? And a lot of times that's really different. My Marissa Morby, who is my my partner, does this sort of research for companies, and she's very good at identifying. It's not like what the marketing says. You got to get through when somebody repeats your marketing back to you, and then wait for them to say the thing that's like why they did it. And some really classic examples of this are like Snickers bars, for example. They have that that ad campaign that we all remember, like you're not you when you're hungry and all that. That was because they did user research. They thought they were competing with stuff like Milky Way and Kit Kat, you know, candy bars, right? When they actually listened to their customers, they found out that people were using Snickers as a meal replacement bar.
Yeah.
So they were picking up a Snickers instead of a sandwich, not a Snickers instead of a Milky Way. So if they had advertised Snickers as like, it's the best candy bar, it wasn't really talking to the people who were using the product. So instead you say, you're not you when you're hungry, and people go, oh, Snickers will make me not hungry. Now they're going to reach for it instead of a, right? It becomes a meal replacement, and because you're using the language that people were using before. And I think that a lot of companies are kind of caught up in like, we invented feature, and feature is the reason people use our product. But ultimately, the feature solves a problem, and the company might not understand what problem it is that that product is solving. You know, like Snickers didn't understand that they were a meal replacement bar until they asked their customers. And I think a lot of tech companies are like that, where they've built something really cool, but it's not being used the way people expected. And I think that's why there are famous stories of pivots, like, you know, like what was it? Instagram was something completely different. Slack was something completely different. Like, you know, we build these things thinking they'll be something, and then they absolutely surprise us in the way people hold them.
Totally. Yeah. I want to talk to Marissa on this too, because I know she has so much. She's just so smart and cool. So I'm excited. I'm emailing her after this, but I'll cut all that out. Tell me a little bit, I know we're wrapping up, but tell me a little bit about your creative office space bunker that you've created in Portland. It seems so cool from all the pictures I've seen and just your background there.
Yeah. So this is again, my curse of like, if I see a way that I could do it, I like can't not do it that way. And I've seen other creators have put together like giant, you know, 10,000 square foot warehouses that they're converting into multiple sets and all these things. I didn't do that, but I did do 2,000 square feet. And so it's not small by any means.
Wow.
So I have a warehouse. It used to be a manufacturing plant for a bicycle bag company. So it's big, it's open, there are electrical outlets everywhere. And so we can just sort of reconfigure the space very quickly to make a different set. So this is actually the only real wall is not visible. Like this behind me is a set wall and it rolls. So I can move this and put it somewhere else. And all of the, you know, I'm surrounded by like different gear that I can sort of reconfigure if we want to do an interview on a couch, or if we want a set that sort of looks like an office or whatever it is, we can reconfigure those things very quickly. And my goal is I want this to be one, if you have an idea, I want the only barrier to be like having the idea, not having the idea and then figuring out where you're going to film it and how you're going to get the right look or whatever. And then the other thing is I really believe that if you create a space where creative people are kind of together in concentration, much bigger things happen than any one of them could do independently. So my long-term selfish goal is I want Learn with Jason Studios to become like a third place for people who are creative, in the hopes that that also means that we all start collaborating together and we all make more interesting stuff together than we would have on our own. And I, like, that's happened a few times, like True, who I talked about earlier, will hang out in the studio sometimes and I'll be doing something. And she's like, that'd make a great video. And she just pulls out her phone. And I love it when she does that because she reminds me that I don't have to overthink this stuff. You can just have an idea and shoot it. Right. And like, I've helped her do more like skit based stuff. And, you know, I had Adam Argyle from the Google Chrome DevRel team came down here and we filmed a whole bunch of stuff all at once. And it just sort of like you get this opportunity to bring people together and have that brainstorming session and go off the walls. And then you go, all right, we've got time to do two things. Which two things do you want to do? And we've already got all the stuff here. We can just kind of roll the cameras around and make it happen. So yeah, this space has been partially just like, I think there's legitimacy to be bought in a certain way. Like, part of the reason I moved to Portland was because I wanted to raise my rates, and people would kind of balk at the idea of a design and web agency from Montana. But when I went to Portland, I was able to raise my rates 30%, and people just said, oh yeah, well, Portland is where good stuff happens, so I'll pay that. And I think the same thing is sort of true. Like, if you say you've got a studio and that you're a video producer, people just believe you. Whereas if you say like, I make videos in my bedroom at home, you're still a video producer, but selling that idea to somebody else, it's like a psychological thing. Like, I believe I'm more capable because I go to my space. I am in my creative space doing my creative thing versus like, okay, I'll roll out of bed and I'll like move some stuff so that you can't see that there's dirty clothes in that corner, and then I'll record. And that's what I did for years, right? And it was like sort of a, this was like my gift to myself as an indie creator. I was like, if I'm going to do this full time, I'm going to do this full time.
Yeah. Do it for real. I love that.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Well, Jason, thank you so much for being part of this today. I admire you so much and I think you're amazing. Everybody should check out all of your, they have seen them, but all of your amazing videos. Every company should engage with you to make the most funny, interesting videos out there. Anything you want to plug or promote, anything like that?
The obvious thing is like, please go check me out. Learn with Jason everywhere. So learnwithjason.dev or on YouTube or whatever. And then if you're a company and you want to collaborate on some stuff, I have a lot of fun doing it. I think you'd have a lot of fun doing it, and it'll be something that is maybe a little more memorable than like yet another webinar or tutorial. So, you know, let's be friends.
Let's all be friends. Hire Jason. Let's go check it all out. Thank you so much for being part of the show. Thank you for listening to The Last Tech Podcast, and we'll see you next time. All right.
The Last Tech Podcast.